I don't know if you've noticed this or not, but in every, at least every celebrated trial, there are really two great storylines that go on. There's the trial that takes place, what goes on in the courtyard, and there's the story of what takes place outside of the courtyard. You know, like you have, what do you have, the O.J. Simpson trial, or you, whatever trial you talk about. There's always an artist's rendition of what's going on in the courtroom, and they're describing what happens here, what happens. Of course, that trial, they actually televised, didn't they? But there's actually a recording of what goes on inside the courtroom, but then there's a whole other scene that takes place on the courtroom steps. You know, the lawyers get out there, and they give their speeches after their presentations, and the parents are out there, and the family members, and the other people that are related, then there's this whole other theme, this whole other story that's going on while the trial's, you know, being conducted in an official fashion. And in many respects, that's what's going on here with Jesus in his trial before the Sanhedrin, before Caiaphas, the high priest. Jesus is taken in, and there's an official sort of trial, though we're going to see it's not really as official as it ought to have been. Nevertheless, there's this trial going on in the courtroom, and then there's another trial, as it were, another inquisition that's going on with Peter in the courtroom. And if you begin to compare how the two people responded, how does Jesus respond to the accusations, and how does Peter respond to his accusations, you see the difference between night and day, don't you? Jesus responds with the accusations in the affirmative. I am who you say. Peter responds, I'm nothing who you say. I'm not anywhere near the person you say. And there is a dichotomy that takes place. Peter denies his Lord, and Jesus reaffirms who he is to the point that it even sends him to the cross. So we're going to look this morning at these two inquisitions, these two trials, if you were, that take place, one inside the courthouse, one outside the courthouse. And first of all, we'll look at Jesus before the high priest, Caiaphas. Now, there's a lot of debate amongst biblical scholars as to whether or not the trial that Jesus is engaged in here in verses 20, chapter 26, 57 through 68, if that is really a real trial or not. I mean, there's a lot of irregularities that don't seem to be what they were supposed to be. For example, trials were not supposed to be held at night, particularly capital trials in which you could be sentenced to death. And yet this trial is hastily arranged in the middle of the night. Later on, there are documents that suggest that the trial should not have been held in the household of Caiaphas the high priest. At least that was the rule 200 years later. We're not sure exactly what the rules were at this particular point in history. But nevertheless, there's a lot of odd things that happened in the trial where Jesus is drugged before Caiaphas the high priest. First of all, it happens at night. Second of all, there's a lot of false witnesses that have been arranged to say certain things. In other words, it looks like, if you look at verse 59, like the verdict has already been determined beforehand, which wouldn't be a trial at all, obviously, because the point of a trial is to determine a verdict. But it says in verse 59 that the chief priest and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus, that they might put him to death. So they had already decided they wanted to put Jesus to death. They were just trying to figure out, how are we going to do this? And they arranged a whole bunch of false witnesses to bear speak lies about Jesus. The witnesses that they do arrange seem not to agree on their stories. That's what Matthew tells us. In verse 60, they find a nun who can bring a good enough witness against him, basically. Though many false witnesses come forward, at last two come forward and say, "This man said, I am able to destroy the temple and to rebuild it in 3 days." Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because in the Old Testament law, at least why was it important to have two witnesses? In the Old Testament law, you couldn't put anybody to death. In fact, you couldn't even convict anybody of a crime unless two people corroborated the story. In other words, you needed at least two witnesses to say, "I saw so-and-so take the money," or "I saw so-and-so murder somebody." And that is what you needed in order to have a conviction. So they need two witnesses to come and collaborate the same story. They can't find two witnesses that will agree on the same story. The only story they can find two witnesses to agree on is the story that Jesus said, "I will destroy the temple and in 3 days rebuild it." Of course, interestingly enough, that's not what Jesus said. And, interestingly enough, that is something that is a paraphrase of something that he said 3 years earlier. And when basically he was talking about the temple of his body. At least that's what John tells us when he said, in John chapter 2, Jesus says, "What the Jews are asking Jesus, what sign do you show us for doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And then John goes on in John 2, verse 20, to tell us that the Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days." But he was speaking about the temple of his body. So it was pretty clear, at least to the disciples, that Jesus wasn't talking about the temple of Jerusalem. He was talking about the temple of his body. He was saying, "Destroy my body, and in 3 days I will rise it up, raise it up. That will be the sign that I am who I say that I am." And so they take the words of Jesus, they twist them around and say, Jesus is talking about the temple. Interestingly enough, it seems as if even Caiaphas himself understood that Jesus was not talking about the actual temple. Because if you flip over to Matthew 27, and if you look at, what verse is that in Matthew 27? Where verse 62... the next day after the preparation, this is after Jesus had died, the chief priest and the Pharisees gather before Pilate and say, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise.'" Interestingly enough, Caiaphas knows the prophecy that Jesus said that he will rise from the dead on 3 days. So I'm a little suspicious here that Caiaphas knew exactly what Jesus was talking about when he said, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it up." And Caiaphas knows he's not talking about the temple of God. He's not talking about the temple in Jerusalem. He's talking about his body. Nevertheless, they're going through this trial, and you sort of say to yourself, is this really a trial at all, or is this what we would call a show trial? You know, something to just go through the motions so that we can make ourselves feel like we've had justice prevail here. Obviously, justice is not prevailing. They treat Jesus violently at the end. They begin to strike him and to spit on him. This is not the way you treat prisoners. Jesus appears not to have any legal defense. It doesn't appear like anybody's standing up for him, though we don't have all of the details of everything that's going on here. There's just a lot of odd things going on in this trial. Oh, there's one other interesting thing going on here. In Jewish law, they're trying to follow Jewish law, you know, by running Jesus through this trial. And in Jewish law, if a person bore false witness against another person, in other words, if you were called as a witness and you lied on the witness stand, the punishment that was due the defendant is the punishment that could have come upon you for lying. Understand? In other words, if you say, "I saw the person steal the bread, but they didn't steal the bread," whatever the punishment for stealing bread, and you were found to lie on the witness stand, that punishment could fall on you. So when these false witnesses are coming forward and they're saying, "We saw Jesus," the punishment by being false witnesses, they were making themselves guilty of the crime that they were accusing the person of. But you don't see the scribes or the Pharisees or the high priest pursuing that line of questioning, do you? Because they're not concerned with that. They're concerned with nailing Jesus to the cross. They're concerned with getting rid of Jesus. Well, despite all of this attempt they have to sort of make this case against Jesus in the courtroom, they're having a hard time making the case. Because at the end of the day, you know, if Jesus says, "Destroy the temple," and he actually meant the temple of Jerusalem, all you need to do is sort of stand around and wait for Jesus to try to destroy it. You know, wait for him to take a hammer and start chipping away at the stone. Then you have a case against him. But nobody's seen Jesus do this. All they've heard is him say things, and what they've heard him say isn't exactly what he said. And so the case against Jesus is actually falling apart at this particular point in the story, until crafty and rather sneaky Caiaphas, the high priest himself, who I would assume Caiaphas is supposed to be the judge, not the prosecuting attorney. Nevertheless, he's acting like the prosecuting attorney. And in verse 63, Jesus, it says, Jesus remains silent. In other words, he's not answering the false accusations against him. And finally, the high priest says to him in verse 63, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Now at that point, the trial hinges and turns. Because Caiaphas is doing and saying a couple of different things. The first thing he says is, I adjure you by the living God. Now that's actually an important statement. Because in Leviticus chapter 5, verse 1, here's what it says. I'll just read you some Old Testament law this morning. If anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet does not speak, he shall bear his iniquity. Now, what that means is you can be compelled, if you've seen, if you've witnessed something, the judge can compel you to testify. And if you refuse to testify against what you have seen, you are guilty of a crime. That he shall bear his iniquity. And what it goes on to say in Leviticus is, you were guilty of the very crime that you witnessed by failing to testify. So what Caiaphas is doing is he's using an Old Testament lawyerly trick. He's saying, all right, based on Leviticus, I am injuring you, I am demanding that you act as a witness. Now, in our country, this would be illegal because we have Miranda rights. You can't act as a witness against yourself. But he's doing this. He's quoting the Old Testament law to Jesus, and he's saying, Jesus, I demand that you give testimony about who you are. You seem to be the only one in the courtroom who knows, so you give testimony to who you are. And then he says this, tell us if you are the Christ, that would be the Messiah, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Now, interesting, Caiaphas does not say, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of David. He says, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. In other words, he is equating the Messiah with being the Son of God. You see, probably in technical terms, it isn't against the law, at least it isn't a capital offense, for a person to come on the scene and claim to be a Messiah. I mean, this happened all the time in Jerusalem. People would come along, they would claim to be the Messiah. And where they got themselves in trouble was not by claiming to be the Messiah. Where they got themselves in trouble was by acting as if they were the Messiah and getting a band of followers and getting some clubs and swords and things together and starting a revolt. That's when they got themselves in trouble, these Messiah-type things. But just claiming to be the Messiah wasn't technically a capital crime. That couldn't get you in trouble. That couldn't get you killed. But Caiaphas adds his claim to be the Messiah to being the Son of God. And he doesn't say, are you a Son of God? Because even the Jews understood that they were all sons of God at some level. But he says, are you the Son of God? In other words, he's implying that Jesus, have you claimed to be the Christ, the unique Son of God? Now what this tells me is that Caiaphas had been paying very, very close attention to what Jesus had been teaching and saying, because that's exactly who Jesus claimed to be. He did claim to be the Messiah. He did claim to be the unique Son of God. And so Caiaphas is saying, all right, based on Old Testament law, I am demanding that you give witness to the fact, are you the Messiah plus the Son of God? Now see, here's where he has Jesus. Because if Jesus says yes to this, then Caiaphas can accuse him of blasphemy. Blasphemy was punishable by death, therefore that could lead to the cross. So you're Jesus. Jesus, who's oftentimes got himself off the hook by coming up with an incredibly clever answer. He has, up until this point, said nothing at his trial. And that has produced nothing but a bunch of false witnesses which weren't going to condemn him any. What do you do if you're Jesus? Do you keep your mouth shut? Do you say nothing? Because if you say nothing, then you can be accused of not giving witness to the truth and this and that and the other thing. Or do you say something and then you say something clever, but you say it in a way that keeps you from getting convicted? What does Jesus do? What does he do with Caiaphas's demand? Well, he not only answers the question, but he answers a question in a way that guarantees he will go to the cross. In other words, Jesus has this unique opportunity to answer this question in a way that sort of fudges the edges, that sort of skirts that's legal but sort of skirts the particulars of it. But Jesus doesn't do that. He sort of like puts the pedal to the floor and he says, all right, here we go. And here's what he says in verse 64. He says, Jesus says to him, you have said so. Now this is another way of saying, your words are technically correct, Caiaphas. When you call me the Messiah, the Son of God, your words are technically correct. But it's not true in the way you understand it. You see, he says, you have said so, but I tell you, and then he's going to explain how he understands it. In other words, he's saying to Caiaphas, you're right, you're correct in what you say. Your words are true, but it's not in the sense that you think they're true. You think the Messiah is this person that's going to lead this revolt against Rome, he's going to overthrow the city, he's going to have this legions of army, he's going to ride into town on a horse, and he's going to fight this great battle, and he's going to deliver you from Rome. You think the Son of God is this and the Son of God is that. He said, you got it all right. Your words are correct, but your understanding is wrong. And so here's what he does. He begins to clarify who he is before Caiaphas. And he says this in verse 64, but I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now what Jesus does there when he says that is he quotes the Old Testament verse from Daniel chapter 7. And the verses come from Daniel 7:13 and 14. Let me just read them from Daniel. Daniel sees in verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples and nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion and shall not pass away, and his kingdom is one that shall not be destroyed. Jesus says, Caiaphas, you understand the Messiah to be this way, and you understand the Son of God to be this way, but now let me tell you what the true Son of God, let me tell you what I really am. I am the Son of Man prophesied in Daniel, who is going to come in the clouds of heaven. Now, there's a lot of discussion about what Daniel was seeing here, what exactly it's referring to. And I think what it's referring to is the enthronement of God himself in his heavenly throne. It's the enthronement that Christ experienced after the crucifixion and the resurrection and ascension. He is ushered into heaven and he sits at the right hand of God the Father, and God gives him power and God gives him authority and God gives him all the power and authority that's normally ascribed to God the Father is now thrust upon Jesus himself, and Jesus rules the world from his heavenly throne. And Jesus is telling Caiaphas, you're expecting an earthly Messiah, you're expecting small things. I'm telling you, the Messiah that I am is the Messiah that one day you will see seated at the right hand of God the Father. You will see me equal to the Father in heaven. The next time, right now you're seeing me as a participant in your courtroom, but the next time you see me, you will be in my courtroom. I will be judging you because I will be at God's right hand. In other words, you know, Jesus, he says, yeah, let me tell you what kind of Messiah I am. I'm the Messiah that is equal to God himself. Typically, the Old Testament scholars, the Jewish scholars, did not equal the Messiah with God. You know, typically the Messiah was simply an adult or a male figure that had been descended through the line of David. They did not equate the Messiah himself with God. But when Caiaphas asked the question, he's equating the Messiah with God, and Jesus says, "You're right. I am God himself, and I am the one." The Messiah. But I'm not the earthly Messiah that's going to bring battle. I am the Son of Man. I am the representative of mankind who will one day sit at the right hand of God and exercise my authority. Jesus, who could have said nothing and probably have skated at least the legal, he could have gotten out of this thing legally, reveals the truth as it really is. And at this point, Caiaphas says, we've heard enough. The high priest in verse 65 tears his robes. This is what you were supposed to do when you heard blasphemy. You were supposed to tear your robes. He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. So all of these false witnesses couldn't say anything bad about Jesus. Jesus himself speaks the words that will condemn him. Jesus himself affirms the words that will send him to the cross. Now, blasphemy is simply putting yourself in the place of God, or ascribing to yourself the characteristics that are only God, or taking God's name in vain in a way that you take that authority upon yourself. And Jesus is either blaspheming in what he is saying, or he is speaking the truth. Now, there is a reason Jesus does this. And the reason is this. Because Jesus does not want to go to the cross being accused of a false crime. He doesn't want to go to the cross because some false witness came up and said, I heard you say so and so, and that isn't really what Jesus said. And the high priest gets upset and they send Jesus to the cross based on that. Jesus wants to go to the cross based on what is true. And Jesus is going to the cross on his own terms. If they're going to hang me on the cross, is what he's saying, they're going to hang me on the cross because I claimed to be the Messiah, the Son of God. Which is exactly what he was. He goes to the cross not for a lie. He goes to the cross for speaking the truth. Who are you, Jesus? I'm the Messiah. I'm the Son of God. I'm the Son of Man representing all of mankind before God himself in his heavenly throne, and I am God's own unique, only begotten Son. That's the legal sense in which Jesus went to the cross. And that's the terms that he wants to go to the cross on. He wants to go to the cross because he spoke the truth, not because somebody else spoke a lie about him. Now contrast this whole scene with Peter. Peter's out in the courtroom where the second story is taking place on this particular night. A little servant girl, a little girl, comes up to him in verse 69 while Peter's outside, and she says to him, you also were with Jesus the Galilean. But Peter denies it. A little bit later, another servant girl comes up to him with a group of bystanders in verse 71. And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl said to him and said to the bystanders, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he denied it, only this time he denies it with an oath. So the first time he lies, he denies it. The second time he lies and then says an oath, I promise what I'm saying is true. I wasn't with this man. A third time, there are some bystanders in verse 73. In verse 73, there are some bystanders, and after a little while, they come up and say to Peter, certainly, you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you. Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know the man. So first he lies, then by denying Jesus, then he lies with an oath, and then the third time, he lies with a curse. In other words, you know, liar, liar, pants on fire, stick a needle in my eye, whatever. You know, he brings a maledictory oath to himself if he's lying. And in other words, he gets bolder and bolder in his lying as he goes on. Jesus denied his Lord. The same Peter who said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, back in Matthew chapter 15, now says, I never knew the guy. Peter denied his heart. There's no doubt that Peter loved Jesus. You know, there weren't any other disciples. Well, John was probably with Peter in the courtyard. We learned that from John. But there weren't any other disciples that were getting this close to Jesus. Why was he there in the first place? Peter loved Jesus more than any of the other disciples, or he wouldn't have been there. He loved Jesus, but his denial is a denial of his heart when he says, I never knew the man. And Peter denied his identity. For 3 years, Peter has identified himself not as a fisherman, not as a husband, not as a father, not as a businessman, not as a traveler. He's defined himself as a follower of Jesus. For 3 years, he's been with Jesus. It isn't just that he was with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, like these people are accusing him of. He's been with Jesus for 3 years. That has been his identity. He had the T-shirt and the little badge that he wore. I'm a disciple of Jesus. And when push comes to shove, he denies it. He denies his Lord. He denies his heart, and he denies his identity. And I'm wondering why. Why would he do that? Why would you do that? Was he afraid? What was he afraid of? Was he afraid of his life? Well, that could be possible. I mean, they did want to kill Jesus. So if they want to kill Jesus, then maybe they want to kill the disciples as well. So maybe he is afraid for his life. Maybe that's the reason that he denies Jesus. Or maybe he's a fear for his reputation. You know, everybody wants to be your friend when you're famous and when you have your face on the cover of the magazines and on television, but nobody wants to know you when you're the scoundrel. You know, I was reading this week about the funeral of Lee Harvey Oswald. Nobody was at his funeral. There were no pallbearers at his funeral. Do you realize that? Because nobody wanted to be around the guy. His family were there, his wife and his mother and a few of the family members. But there weren't enough people to carry his casket, so they had to get the reporters. There were more reporters there than anybody else. And the reporters carried Lee Harvey Oswald's casket to the grave to bury him. The minister didn't even show up. The minister that was supposed to be there didn't show up. Because nobody wants to be around a scoundrel, but when you're famous, everybody wants to be around you. So maybe Peter is concerned about his reputation. Jesus is going down in flames, but I don't know. Here's what I'm thinking lately about Peter. Peter was really afraid of losing control. Now hang with me here for a minute. Who is it in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus is arrested that pulls out the sword and is ready to fight for Jesus? It's Peter. John tells us it's Peter. Who was it that when Jesus began to say in Matthew chapter 16 that the Son of Man will be betrayed by the religious leaders, that he will be crucified, that he will be buried, he will rise again on the third day? And Peter was the first one to speak up and say, Lord, never. May it never be. This is not going to happen to you. Peter doesn't want Jesus to go to the cross. Peter doesn't want a Messiah that's going to die and suffer and shed his blood. Peter doesn't want any. Peter wants a Messiah that's going to be strong, that's going to be powerful, one that'll take out a sword and fight if there's a battle to be fought. That's the kind of Messiah Peter wants. And I'm not so sure that Peter isn't in the courtyard this night because he's holding out hope that maybe there's going to be one last ditch effort where he can seize the situation, where he can rescue Jesus from the cross, because Peter wants to be in control of the future here. And maybe Peter lies about who he is and about who he knows is because he's looking for an opportunity to seize control and once again prevent Jesus from going to the cross, despite the fact that Jesus said over and over and over, this is going to happen. See, Peter objects to the cross. Peter opposes the cross. And Peter, who is quick to take up a sword and die by the sword, is not so quick to take up a cross and die by a cross. What did Jesus say in Matthew chapter 16? In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. By the way, this is right after Peter said, Lord, that's never going to happen to you. And Jesus turns around and says, yeah, not only is it going to happen to me, but it's going to happen to you if you're going to be a follower of me. You know the difference? So Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane takes up a sword, and he's ready to die by the sword, but Peter is not ready to die by the cross. Because you see, when you die by the sword, you die under your own terms. You're in control. You're fighting back. You're using all your strength to defeat the enemy. And if he kills you, he kills you. But when you die by a cross, you're not under control. You're out of control. Somebody else determines your death. Somebody else determines the agony that you go through. Your hands are completely in the hands of another person. And that's what Peter's problem is. Peter wants to be in control. Peter wants to manipulate the situation. I think that's really what's going on here. I think there's a control issue going on with Peter. I don't think he wants Jesus to go to the cross. Would you have wanted Jesus to go to the cross? Take your pick. Do you want a Messiah that's going to that's going to ride a white horse in with an army and save the day, or do you want a Messiah that's going to shed his blood on a cross and die for you? It's not very noble going to the cross, is it? I'm not so sure Peter isn't trying to avoid it. Jesus isn't trying to avoid it, though. Jesus knows that he needs to go to the cross, and not only does he know he needs to go to the cross, but he guarantees that he will go to the cross by speaking the words that he does, by claiming to be the Son of God, the Messiah, come to save mankind. Peter, on the other hand, doesn't have enough courage to face the cross. And so as a result, verse 75, he hears the rooster crow. He remembers the words of Jesus in the previous encounter that Peter's had with Jesus, where Jesus said, "You're going to deny me before the rooster crows. And Peter, in verse 75, runs out and he weeps bitterly. There is hope for Peter. Because you know what? By running out, he was giving up control. And by weeping bitterly, he was beginning to humble himself and begin to rethink his position on life. You know, humility is the first step to being reborn. And Peter needed to be reborn. His attitude needed to be reborn. His heart needed to be reborn. Because Jesus was going to the cross, whether Peter wanted him to go or not. Because Jesus needed to die for the sins of Peter. And Jesus needed to die for the sins of you and me. And that's why Jesus insisted on going to the cross. Why is Peter's courage so failing and Jesus' courage so strong? Because Peter's courage is based on Peter's strength, on Peter's plan, and on Peter's agenda. Jesus' courage and strength is based on God's plan, on God's strength, and on God's agenda. In order for Peter to have the courage of Jesus, Peter needed to get rid of Peter and have more Jesus. And eventually that would happen, wouldn't it? Because eventually Peter does speak up for Jesus publicly. And eventually Peter does go to the cross. And eventually Peter does go through all the persecution and suffering that Jesus went through. And what's the difference between Peter in Acts and Peter in Matthew? The difference is because Peter in Acts is acting in the strength and the power and the plan of Jesus. And Peter in Matthew is acting under the strength and power and plan of Peter, the man. I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I don't think I'm a Christian, but I don't think I could ever withstand persecution. And you know, you're right. You can't withstand persecution. That's the reason you and I need Jesus. Because we can never face the difficulties of life, the persecution of life. We can never face the inquisitions of life apart from the power of Christ. And so our hope is not in our own strength. Our hope is in the strength of Jesus. The strength that took him to the cross is the same strength that we can have, the same spirit that we can have, that will enable us to do extraordinary things if we get rid of ourselves and start taking more of Jesus. Let's pray. Father, help us not to find the strength of Peter, but help us to find the strength of Jesus, who knew who he was, who knew why he was here and where he was going. Help us to have more Jesus and less of ourselves. Be at work within us in such a way that our weakness turns to strength, that our timidity turns to boldness. Give us the power that can only come through your Spirit as we seek to serve you and live for you. In Jesus' name, amen.